Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. I have with me Michelle Perkins, and Michelle is back again, as always. Great to talk to you. For somehow, people are somehow still missing every single time who you are. Let's go through this again.
So hi, I'm Michelle Perkins. As you said, I'm an emergency room doctor in down east rural Maine, and it's a pleasure to be on again, Chip. Thanks so much for having me.
And I love having you on all the time because you're practicing in Maine. I'm practicing in Missouri. Even though both states start with an M, we have some similarities in our patient populations. But for the most part, I mean, we deal with some different issues. And one of them is with tick-borne diseases, because there's some things that you see up in Maine that I don't see down here. And I think vice versa. This is kind of a neat podcast, I think, because I think between the two of us, we've probably seen all of the tick-borne diseases that are going to come up here. It makes sense, since this is the end of the year, that we should now talk about tick-borne diseases because, you know, when it comes time to flu season, since that's, you know, basically right around the corner, we'll save that, or may even be going on depending on where you're at. We might as well save that for May.
Right.
So we talked about doing a flu podcast, but, you know, screw it. We'll wait until May. So look out for it then.
Right. Why rush things?
When it comes to tick-borne diseases, there's obviously a ton of them, and they can be transmitted all sorts of fun ways. You got viruses, bacteria, parasites even. And I just think they're horrible little nasty little buggers. I feel like, and I'd be curious your thoughts, Michelle, but to me, ticks are those little bastards that I don't know why they exist. Like everything has a purpose in life. At least I feel like it's supposed to. Like, you know, X creature serves this role. What the hell do ticks serve a purpose for besides spreading disease?
Yeah, they're vectors. That's basically that. They're their only purpose, and to completely skeeve me out when they're like crawling around in somebody's ear. Those are their two purposes. I hate that so much.
It's still better than a cockroach.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah. Totally.
Obviously, there are a shit ton of different ticks, and you decided to show us some nice pictures with it, which we're going to have on the show notes as well. But can you kind of walk us through a little bit of all this fun stuff?
Worldwide, there are about 800 species of ticks, but here in the U.S., we basically deal with approximately 80, and the vast majority of them belong to the, and I looked this up to see how to pronounce it, Exotidae family. And they're
very fancy.
You like that? The most common vector here in the U.S. is the deer tick or the black-legged tick, which is Exotes scapularis, or your typical deer tick. And these are found basically in the Northeast, the South, and the Midwest. And the season is basically anytime it's above freezing. So we'll have people coming in with tick bites. I don't know if it's the same with you, but in the winter. So this is really a topical, timely topic, basically year-round. But they can transmit really a lot of the bad ones. They transmit Lyme, anaplasmosis, and babesiosis. So there's something certainly to be watched out for. And another kind of up-and-coming star in the tick population is the Lone Star tick. It was generally initially in the Southeast U.S., but now it's becoming more and more widespread. It's kind of spreading up the coast, basically found just about anywhere. And they can transmit ehrlichiosis and tularemia. And dog ticks we usually think of as pretty benign, or at least I do around here, but they can transmit tularemia and Rocky Mountain spotted fever. So they're certainly still something to be concerned about.
We kind of almost skipped part of this, and that's my fault. But I mean, the thing with these ticks and what makes it so hard is that even without a known tick bite, you can get the tick-borne symptoms and stuff like that. And some of these take so long to manifest that sometimes they have fevers, but they don't, or a rash, or they don't, or neuro symptoms, or they don't. I mean, it just makes it so hard. And a lot of times patients will just say, yeah, I was bit by a tick, but they have no idea what kind of tick. They can't describe it in any way, shape, or form. It's just something that's a little brown and pesky.
Right. And they don't know how long it's been on, and they don't know, you know, basically anything more about it than that. Whether or not it was engorged, they just got it out of there as soon as they could a lot of times. And the other thing that makes it really challenging too is because all these ticks can carry more than one disease, it is not uncommon to see a co-infection. So if you're seeing somebody like, oh, well, I think there's some sort of illness, you still have to always consider what else they could be co-infected with at the same time. So it really makes tick-borne illnesses one of the more challenging things that we deal with.
And that's why the history and physical are important, but at the same time, I just don't feel like they're usually super helpful in the actual diagnosis. And then there's the issue with the labs.
Yeah, labs really aren't that helpful at all. And I mean, serology is something you're going to be sending if you're thinking about tick-borne illnesses. But that's a key point right there, because if you're not thinking about it, you're not going to diagnose. But the serology isn't helpful because it's always a send-out. It doesn't help in the acute phase when you're seeing the patient in the moment. So basically, the guidelines are, if you're suspicious, you don't want to delay treatment for any sort of serologic confirmation. Because if you do, in some of these instances, it can be deadly.
I think that's one of the biggest things, like, to take away right here is don't rely on the serology. In fact, most of these can be treated the same way. And so, you know, basically, if you have any suspicion and you really think it's what's going on, yeah, you can get some lab work and maybe sometimes it can help point you one way or the other. But a lot of times you're just going to have to, you know, basically kind of trust your gut and do the testing as a means of follow-up, because sometimes you may find something different than you're expecting. I've had that happen plenty of times. But fortunately, usually the treatment's the same. And so go ahead and treat. Don't wait for the confirmatory test.
Well, it's one of the things that makes it challenging is when you get into all the kind of individual illnesses is that so many of them present like exactly the same. You know, and so you won't have any idea. So you're just basically kind of honing your diagnosis to some tick-borne illness and treating them. And like you said, it's very fortunate that most of them are treated the exact same way.
Yeah, so let's go through some of these conditions. I guess the first one is anaplasmosis.
Right, and these are transmitted by the same ticks that you see with Lyme and babesiosis. So it's basically the same geographic distribution that you see, upper Midwestern and the northeastern U.S. And they present with that nice, lovely, vague symptomatology that you could throw into any sort of viral wastebasket, which makes it challenging. They show up with fever, headache, malaise, sometimes with some nausea and vomiting and cough. But with anaplasmosis, there's generally no rash, but you can have one. So don't let that throw you off either way.
I feel like so many of these is the same kind of vague stuff, fever, headache, malaise, GI stuff, maybe a rash, maybe not. Maybe they have all this, maybe they have none of it. Like, it's such a pain in the ass to try and figure this out. But the labs can sometimes show like anemia, thrombocytopenia, and then maybe sometimes a little bit of a change in their LFTs.
You're sort of classically taught that if you do a checkup peripheral smear on these people, but you're not to rely on that finding to rule it in or rule it out, because they're wicked hard to find. And even if you see what you think is that, that might not necessarily be. So if you see it and it's clear, great. But if you don't, that doesn't mean they don't have anaplasmosis. It just means that it's a kind of a faulty test.
But the good news is that you'll treat this like pretty much all the other tick-borne diseases. Doxycycline, 100 milligrams twice daily, right?
Yeah, so the dogma is around doxycycline. We were always taught that you've got to avoid using it in kids under the age of 8. Because there was a theoretical risk of some tooth staining, but really this hasn't been borne out to be the case. So both the CDC and the American Association of Pediatrics Committee on Infectious Disease say just use the doxy. It's safe and it works. And you run the risk of having treatment failure if you use some alternative because you're scared of using it. So just use the doxy.
There have even been updates by the American Academy of Pediatrics supporting this role as well. So this was something that was actually more related with tetracycline versus actually doxycycline. And it just basically gave doxycycline inadvertently a bad name as well. But even other organizations support the use of doxycycline now.
Right.
All right. So now one of the ones that I see a lot in Missouri and is a big one and can be quite a dangerous one, I've noticed in the past. At least it makes people horribly, horribly sick, is ehrlichiosis.
We tend to talk about them kind of the same in that their clinical presentation is almost identical, even though it's a different geographic distribution, different tick, different bug. But yes, yeah, so I see the anaplasmosis, you see the ehrlichiosis, but they act pretty similar.
I mean, the labs, again, you're looking for the leukopenia, the thrombocytopenia, again, that mild elevation in LFTs, and then like the peripheral smear shows, is that Morulay?
I believe so, yes. I didn't look that one up.
Again, you don't want to really count on these. Just treat with doxycycline. Once again, it's amazing.
Because these people are showing up the exact same way. You're just like, kind of shrug my shoulders. Hopefully doxy's going to work again.
And then for our next one, I call it babesiosis, but you call it differently. And how did you say that again?
I said it probably wrong is how I said it. So babesiosis, that makes a lot more sense. All right, I'm going to let you say it from here on out.
No. I'm probably wrong too. I've only ever like actually got to diagnose one of these. It was such a weird case too, because apparently we don't get it very often in Missouri. And I got the one case of it that year in Missouri. Like I didn't personally have it. I diagnosed the case. I should phrase it like that. But I found it really cool. It's called Nantucket fever.
Yeah, well, it was originally up in our area. I have honestly never seen a case of this. But this used to be called Nantucket fever because it was pretty much endemic on the island. But now the geographic distribution is, again, upper Midwest, northeastern is where we generally see it. But again, it's not all that common. Like I said, I've never seen it, or at least I've never diagnosed it. That's a very important distinction. But what makes this one a little bit more unique is that it's has a really long incubation period. So the presentation can be kind of muddled because somebody can show up a month after having a tick bite and have this illness. Incubation can make the diagnosis of this pretty challenging. And people do get pretty sick with this. So making this is important in this instance.
You need to get your phone.
No, I need to ignore it. It's political, I'm sure. Sorry about that.
No, you're fine. Well, it beats the dog barking from last time.
Right. He's being very quiet today. I'm so proud of him.
Okay. Sorry. Beside that. But yeah, this is tricky because patients with babesiosis, I mean, they can be anywhere from the asymptomatic to the life-threatening type. And definitely with the guy, because like I said, I've only had one case of this. We were really thinking that, okay, he's got a tick-borne disease. It makes sense. He works outside a lot. He does a lot of stuff. And we went ahead and we sent the testing out, but our testing took us a couple of weeks to get back. And so in the meantime, he keeps getting worse. You know, the fevers, chills, malaise, headache, all that stuff. And then, you know, just like you'll sometimes see the dark urine and hepatosplenomegaly. Fortunately, he didn't get into some of the really severe stuff that we worry about, like DIC. And hepatorenal failure, which usually happens in the elderly and immunocompromised. But fortunately, even though he was older, he was still pretty healthy. But we just couldn't find anything. We couldn't find the classic stuff. You know, you're looking for that hemolytic anemia or thrombocytopenia, or on the peripheral smear, the Maltese cross type sign, you know, similar to malaria. So instead, we just had to wait this out. And fortunately, by about the time that we realized, okay, this is true treatment failure, then it came back and that he actually had babesiosis. And this is a stretch. This is because nothing else was really working. And funny enough, we were able to treat it with the right antibiotics and he got a lot better very quickly. With the treatment with it, it kind of varies, but etobicoke with azithromycin together for like 7 to 10 days. And then if it's really severe, clindamycin and a quinine together worked. And that's actually what we did with him. And again, these worked out really, really well. And he got better very quickly after that. But this, again, it's slow in presentation and they get bad. And, you know, 5 to 9% of these cases are fatal. So we want to recognize this whenever possible. But keep this on your radar, even if it's not a very common thing to see.
Well, right. And this is one of the exceptions that, you know, kind of makes me nervous because doxy doesn't work. It's like doxy works on everything and it doesn't work on this. I'm assuming that you guys had started him on doxy, your patient?
Yes, exactly. So starting on doxy, and I was doing pretty routinely at that point, every 12 hours for 14 days. I was like, it's got to work for this. And then it didn't work. And I thought, well, maybe it's just because he hasn't had it long enough. Waited a little bit longer, and then he started to get worse. And then we're debating, okay, is this something where, you know, like, what antibiotic do you switch to? And about that time, that's when the stuff finally came back. And so we're able to get it taken care of.
Yeah, but it can get really scary with these people. So I'm glad he turned around.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess now we'll talk about one that's a little more common and highly debatable, I think would be the term for some of its components, Lyme disease.
I mean, this is basically the bane of our existence in our ED. I'm not sure about you.
Oh, everyone thinks they have Lyme disease in Missouri. It's great. Even though There are more important things to focus on than Lyme disease. Like, it's the one that everyone worries about.
Yeah, and to be fair, at least where I live, it is endemic. So I'm much more likely to jump on it than when I was practicing in other places because, I mean, it really, like, everybody here has Lyme. It just seems so. I will say I'm a little bit more free with my treatment here than I used to be in other places that I've worked. But yeah, it's basically, you know, when you look up at your whiteboard and everything says tick bite, you're just like, oh, it's like, this is how my day is going to go. Prophylaxis. Exactly. Yep. Well, we'll talk about that.
Give everyone doxycycline.
Everybody gets doxy. Actually, keep it out in the waiting room. But it is very, you know, it is common. There are upwards of 30,000 cases seen per year. And but it happens to be the one, like you said, there's the most hype, the most hysteria. People are scared to death of it. And there's also the treatments or approaches, shall we say, to this particular illness has a lot of kind of woo and unproven stuff around it. So that's stuff we'll be getting into a little later on. But it's endemic.
Snake oils fix everything.
Right, exactly. Around here, it's CBD oil, but I digress.
Don't even get into that.
Yeah, right. So this is endemic in the Northeast and the upper Midwest again. What makes these cases challenging is how they present depends on how disseminated it is. I mean, you can get them in the early illness, like when they've just been bitten. And what you typically see there is just the erythema migrans, the characteristic bullseye rash. And it, when you see it, it's pathognomonic for Lyme. There's nothing else that really causes that rash, and I do have photos in the show notes for that. But the issue is that, you know, 70-80% of patients don't have this. And so that can make the early diagnosis pretty challenging. But if they have it, then boom, your diagnosis is made and you just treat. They can have in the early localized phase, they can have the concomitant flu-like symptoms, plus or minus fever. So it's a little less dramatic of presentation with the systemic stuff, at least early on with them.
I would just mention real quick that the other thing is when you do send these off for confirmatory testing, do not be surprised. Sometimes you will notice a co-infection with it. In fact, sometimes I've had it where they did not test positive for Lyme, but they tested positive for ehrlichiosis or Rocky Mountain spotted fever or stuff like that, which can always make it a little more confusing. And we didn't really talk about this, but I try to use PCR testing whenever possible. I'd be curious your thoughts behind that.
Oh, I'm in total agreement. I should have mentioned that earlier. When you're sending off a serology, you're not just sending off, oh, I think this is ehrlichiosis, so I'm just sending off this. We have, and I'm sure you have as well, is a tick-borne panel, a PCR panel that checks for a variety of tick-borne illness. So you're not just looking for the one thing. I mean, and with the Lyme, it's a Western blot. It's the ELISA. And if that comes back positive, then it's a Western blot analysis. At least that's how it works with our stuff.
But they do make a PCR of Lyme. It's something you have to look at by your site, because a lot of places, yes, it's the ELISA and Western blot, but a lot of times these will be falsely negative early on. So the PCR, I've noticed, and this is just my personal experience, I don't know how strong the evidence is behind this, but the PCR will pick up things much earlier. And for longer term, and I love to use it in patients where the whole quote-unquote chronic Lyme, which we're going to talk about here in a second, is very beneficial with that. Because it's a lot less subjective than the Western blot and ELISA testing.
Like I said, I think we use the PCR testing for other tick-borne illnesses. I'm not necessarily sure about what we're using for the Lyme as far as that goes, because we send them off and we never see them. They go off to somebody
else.
Never
to be seen or heard from again.
Exactly.
So I'm sorry. So we're talking about disseminating illness. I had to take that sidetrack just because a lot of times with tick panels, the other thing is too, you have to know what is in your local tick panel, because my local tick panel doesn't actually include all the tick-borne stuff. So I have to still add additional tick-borne tests in addition to my tick-borne panel, which makes a lot of sense, right?
Well, right. And I have to check I work at a whole lot of different sites, which I think you do as well. And so every place I go, I check, I call the lab, okay, what is on your panel and what do I need to add on? Because you don't want to miss anything.
And so let's talk about disseminated illness before we go into our rant portion of Lyme disease.
Right. So yeah, when they're disseminated, I mean, basically all bets are off. I mean, this is where you see all that weird stuff that you can see with Lyme. You can have multiple bullseyes. I actually saw this on a guy recently this summer where he had bullseyes everywhere, like far removed from where the original bite was. It was very, actually pretty impressive. You can get, again, the flu-like symptoms, but you can also get rheumatologic manifestations. You get that migratory joint pain, you get muscle pain, you get tendon pain. And it can be starting off as like a monoarthritis, but then tends to be a polyarthritis, affect many sites all over and migratory. So that makes the presentation a little weird. And this is the more dramatic stuff that at least I've seen with this is the cardiac manifestations. I've had two third-degree heart blocks I saw this summer that were probable Lyme. I don't know how often you see that.
I don't really see that very often, but something I heard, and I'd be curious your experience with this, is that when you actually treat the underlying cause, that block actually resolves. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. That's actually one of the few indications for hospitalizing these folks. You hospitalize them for 3 or 4 days of intravenous antibiotics, and that slowly resolves. But yeah, they'll come in with bradycardia, and you look at the EKG and just do a double take. It's like, my God, they're walking, talking here in complete heart block. The last guy, I think he was discharged after... it was like 5 to 7 days he was in the hospital and he was back in sinus. So it does resolve. It's not a permanent block, but it's pretty scary when it happens.
So now all the people who hear third degree block, they're gonna be like, chronic Lyme disease.
Right. Exactly. But, you know, so the heart manifestations, you can also get myocarditis and pericarditis. I haven't seen that as often. But the neuro stuff that you see can be pretty deceptive. I mean, you can see meningitis, you can see encephalitis, and you can see just kind of weird neuropathies. But what I've seen, I don't know what your practice is with this, but when someone presents with isolated Bell's palsy, especially in the high peak times, there's always that debate in my mind. Is this just a Bell's palsy or is this a Lyme manifestation and do I treat? I was reading, there was one, not really article, but kind of a blog post FOMED thing I was reading that's just like, no, you don't have to treat every patient with Bell's palsy for Lyme. But if I'm suspicious, I tend to do so, you know, along with a steroid and what have you. Well, I'd be interested to hear what your thoughts are on that.
I think it's exactly like you said, it's all about the suspicion. So I try and tease out the history really well to see, okay, is there anything that would really honestly suggest a Lyme disease or another tick-borne illness underlying? Because it's really hard to really say, okay, it's Lyme versus something else. But obviously, it's the Lyme that we see these complications in and all those types of things. I don't know if part of that is just because the level of awareness behind it. But for me, it's one of those, when in doubt, and if there's a good history support it, go ahead and treat it that way. To be honest, I haven't had many cases where I suspect that. But that's also, I think, partly because we're in a less endemic area than, say, you would be, where this needs to be further up on your differential.
Yeah, right. And I think, you know, again, it's all clinical judgment. It's what, you know, what you feel fits best with the patient's picture. But young, healthy guy, works in the woods, comes in summertime with a facial droop, I'm probably going to treat him.
Yeah, exactly. And that's again, that good history behind there, where that's a high-risk patient versus, you know, I think, when the last Bell's palsy I had was a girl I don't think has ever been outside her entire life.
Right.
And, you know, she's a student and everything else. And there's more of a viral type picture with her. So yeah, that kind of thing, again, makes it a little bit different than, like you said, the guy who works outside who, you know, hunts and does woodworking and all that kind of stuff where he's going to be outside quite a bit. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And just like with everything, work in making your diagnosis is not going to be helpful. You may see an elevated sed rate or some leukocytosis, but there's generally not much that's going on acutely. And since the serology, like you're talking about, is really not all that sensitive, so you're finding that the PCR is more sensitive.
Yeah, the PCR seems to pick up really well on the acute cases. So I actually try and do PCR whenever possible because it's a yes/no answer. It's not really subjective like the other tests are.
Right. Well, that's actually that's a really good pearl. Have to look into that.
And like I said, I don't have the evidence to back that up. So if someone much smarter than me points out that I'm a complete dumbass and it doesn't work that way, please let me know.
So let me preface that by saying traditionally, Lyme testing was not all that helpful in the first couple of weeks. That may not be the case, but you also can't really distinguish between active and past infection with serology. That's where people run into problems because if you've had Lyme before, you will generally test positive again with some of these tests. And I don't know if PCR is the same with that.
No, actually it's not supposed to be, which is another reason why I like to use it, is because it's only supposed to detect what's currently there.
Which would be very helpful in some of the cases that we're going to talk about.
Like chronic Lyme disease.
Chronic Lyme disease.
It's that time.
Yes, rant time. It's rant time. So, I mean, the very real issue is that Lyme disease can cause chronic problems. That's not in doubt. I mean, people have neurologic manifestations that happen, you know, for years, you know, when they've been treated for appropriately with Lyme. But there's this sort of this idea that's out there now that that an active infection is continuing to smolder, and that's why people are having continued symptoms.
Now, given if someone's not treated for Lyme disease, like say they had that tick bite and they never got it checked out, they never got it treated with doxy, yeah, they will technically have a chronic Lyme disease. Then that's really the disseminated infection that we're talking about. That's really what we're talking about there. That, not the chronic as in it's been treated and appropriately treated, should have been appropriately treated, and they're still having these vague symptoms like what we're talking about.
And that's where you really get into the kind of woo of this, because it's the sort of vague symptoms that patients have been trying to get answers for decades, where we've come up with some rather sketchy diagnoses. And just like with those rather sketchy diagnoses, you get clinicians that are willing to jump on that bandwagon and treat the patient, in my opinion, inappropriately for a condition that doesn't actually exist.
Well, it's because they're woke. Okay.
Yeah, right, right, exactly. And I know my body. But you know, what they're doing to treat these in many instances, I mean, I don't have a problem with, okay, I take some herbs, you'll be all right. But some of these people are having like prolonged, like months to years of multi-drug antibiotic treatment, even parenterally. You know, these people come in with PICC lines. And I know you've got some issues around that.
Oh my gosh, yes. So I've had at least three cases from this particular physician who I will not name, but is very well known for treating chronic Lyme disease in Missouri. And unfortunately, he attracts people from all across the country. And one of those three patients I was talking about moved to Missouri just so they could get this quote unquote special treatment. He is very popular with his patients up until he tries to kill them, basically. He has this whole antibiotic regimen, and he, like you said, gets the parenteral antibiotics, and he has ordered these patients to get these PICC lines. And of course, PICC lines are not without risk. One of those patients specifically was sepsis secondary to a PICC line infection. Another patient I had all these sorts of complications secondary to C. diff colitis because of all the different antibiotics they had been on. And then just all these complications abound where these patients get really, really sick with this treatment. So I am very, very cautious when someone says that they're being treated for chronic Lyme disease, because I want to know exactly what that is and what they've been through. Because there's a good chance that your patient who's now presenting for something completely different, say they are in sepsis, well, and they're going to try and tell you it's their Lyme disease. No, it's probably from that PICC line that you actually have in your arm because you've been treated with all that. And oh, by the way, now it's multi-drug resistant, because you've been giving it every damn antibiotic under the sun for the last year.
Oh, right. Absolutely. And you know, these, and that, like you said, these patients love these doctors because they've given them an answer where nobody else could figure out what's going on.
But the answer wasn't there.
Well, that's the thing. If you look, there was actually a great article I saw. The FDA actually went to some of these labs, and you see that all of them send to these certain labs. Igenix is one you're just going to say. I don't mind saying the name, but they have well over 50% false positive rate. So basically any sample you're going to send, you're going to come back with something positive on it. And that is what they're being treated for. And you always hear from the patients, "Oh, my doctor told me it wasn't Lyme, but it was." And so you're really, you've got an uphill battle when you're seeing these folks, because I guess it's not our place in the ER to disavow them of these notions. But if they come in super sick and you can tell them, "Hey, it's because of this treatment that you're getting for a condition that you don't have," it's kind of an uphill battle, but it can be ultimately rewarding, I would say.
Well, and that's one of the times I'll use the PCR testing specifically, is it's like, okay. And I explain to the patients, I especially love when we've got the results back from the PCR, and I can say, I don't know exactly what he was treating you for or why, but I'll tell you, you do not have Lyme disease. Like, this is not what's causing your issues now. And that to me is a powerful point. Not because I want to be right per se, but I just want to make sure that what is being done is right for the patient.
And oh, one of the things I didn't talk about that I actually left out of here was the whole debate around prophylaxis.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, there really shouldn't be any debate, because the CDC has some, you know, pretty strong guidelines. It's like, well, the tick has to be engorged by history or on for greater than or equal to, like, what is it, 36 hours, I think, and that type of thing. But I will, you know, confess to the nation here that I tend to play a little loosey-goosey with that, because, I mean, frankly, people are coming in to get the prophylaxis. And I, despite my, you know, pretty strong feelings about antibiotic stewardship, I don't think that a single 200 milligram dose of doxy is going to kind of change our, you know, microbiome in the system. I don't know how you feel.
I am pretty much the same way, and I pulled it up real quick. The post-exposure prophylaxis, an engorged Ioxides scapularis tick removed after at least an estimated 36 hours of attachment, which is so hard to know. Prophylaxis started within 72 hours of tick removal. The third part, we're going to just keep it really simple and just say Lyme prevalence in local ticks is known to be greater than 20%, which really, who has that data? Yes, maybe your Department of Natural Resources, but usually that's not really as well known. That doxycycline is not contraindicated, and that patients who cannot take doxy can be started on something else, treatment early if the symptoms were to develop. So, I mean, that's kind of the general recommendations, but long story short, I'm the same way as you are. If someone comes in, that's specifically what they're wanting, and they're pretty insistent about it, it's kind of one of those, just give them the doxycycline, ensure good follow-up. You could potentially try some testing then. I usually tell them that there's a really good chance it's still going to be negative, but we can go ahead, treat them with 200 milligrams, and tell them specifically what they need to watch for. And I feel like that's a pretty good compromise, and it's still safe. And like you said, it's probably unlikely to significantly change your local microbiome.
Right. So glad we're in agreement on that. It's pretty straightforward. Leave happy, and you know, it's better off than if down the road they develop disseminated Lyme and come after you for not giving them that single dose.
Yeah. Yeah. There's that. Or the chronic Lyme disease, you know.
Oh, there we go. If only that ER doc had given me that single dose, I wouldn't need this PICC line.
If only someone had told me that gazpacho soup was best served cold.
Right, exactly.
I don't know if you ever actually have watched Red Dwarf, but that's a common line in there. If only someone had told me.
I will have to watch that.
It is horrible. It is nerdy horrible in a bad way, and you'll thank me for it all sorts later. So.
Excellent. It's on my list. Awesome.
So I guess we can move on from Lyme disease. Is it safe to move from Lyme disease? I feel like it's safe.
I think we're safe now.
Lyme disease. Yeah. So Rocky Mountain spotted fever, I see this a ton. My big three in Missouri that I really focus on, I mean, we technically kind of see all of these, maybe except for the meat allergy one, although we have some patients who have that. I feel like Rocky Mountain spotted fever, ehrlichiosis, and then like Lyme disease is somewhere in the mix there too. We see these a lot, but Rocky Mountain spotted fever for me, I see this all the time. Do you ever get to see this? I don't think it's really in your area.
Well, no. And that was the thing. When I was actually reading about this, I was like terrified reading about this. Cause I mean, I know about it, you know, kind of peripherally because it's on boards and that type of thing, but we just don't see it. So it's not on our radar. But reading some of the case reports, well, little Johnny, we always pick on little Johnny, came into the ED and he had a little bit of a rash and a little bit of a fever, sent him home, and he had disseminated Rocky Mountain spotted fever 5 days later and died.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they are scary.
Holy crap, that's terrifying. That is just absolutely terrifying. So now I'm going to have this on my radar regardless, I think, because it's a really scary illness.
Well, and that's why I explained to parents, and this is a very hard part with Rocky Mountain. I guess we should kind of lead into this a little bit. So in about 60% of these cases are in North Carolina, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Tennessee, and Missouri. So kind of basically in the Ozarks part, with North Carolina weirdly being in there, but we'll ignore that part. But like fevers, chills, malaise, headaches, GI stuff, neurodeficits, photophobia, all this kind of vague stuff. But they've got this macular papular rash, which how often do we see a macular papular rash? Especially in, like you said, kids and adults. It's like, oh my God, it can be anything. And it's within the first few days of illness. But then it transitions into a petechial rash. And we all know that petechial rashes are usually not good rashes to have. And then it just goes downhill quickly.
Well, right. By the time you get to the petechial rash, the horse really is out of the barn, and you're at the point where you really have to be worried about these people dying. I mean, the mortality goes up after a certain period with this, and they don't get to this point until that certain period is up. So your window of treatment is really kind of concerning there, because, you know, you really want to get the antibiotics on board within the first 5 days, because afterwards the risk of fatality goes up pretty dramatically.
And these patients get septic. One of the things that I think is unique on the lab work that you probably won't see with the other tick-borne stuff is the hyponatremia, because again, you'll see the thrombocytopenia, the mild elevation of LFTs, stuff like that. But the hyponatremia is kind of a little bit of a unique part of this.
Right. Yeah. That was the first time that had come up. What was interesting to me is I didn't realize that 10% of people never get a rash. That scared me even more. So how the hell do you diagnose these people?
So again, this is just one of those, thank God you can treat it with doxycycline.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, really, that's the hard part. The rash progresses so rapidly, which is why when kids or adults come in with rashes, I go through this whole, like, if your rash changes over time, and I try and explain, like, petechia in some ways, but usually I'm just like, if your rash is changing, you're getting worse, you need to come back. Because this is one of those things I worry about, is that and some other stuff that can happen along the lines too. Because, you know, sometimes Steven Johnson, for example, not that it's related with this, but Steven Johnson can be kind of like not that impressive when you first start out. And then, holy hell, they turn bad quickly. And that's the tricky part with rashes, right? It's why everyone gets so nervous with rashes, because we all learned in school that rashes can be, oh, sweet and innocent, and fine, all of a sudden it just crashes in on you. And I feel like that's with Rocky Mountain. It's just, at first, it's not that impressive. Like Lyme, at least you get, you know, this bullseye rash, and it kind of sticks out a little bit more. And hey, it's a little more obvious. Then you got a little more time to bite. But Rocky Mountain's a little more aggressive.
Oh, absolutely. I had to stop reading the case reports of the fatalities, because they all started the same with every kid that I've ever sent home with viral rash. So I'm like, okay, stop reading these now, because this is not helping your anxiety level here. But it's pretty scary stuff.
I guess let's kind of move on to one that I admit I don't really think about as much, tularemia.
Yeah, until I was reading about it, it wasn't one that, I mean, I've heard the name.
I think of rabbits. Like, don't you think of rabbits? Did you learn that in school too?
Yes. Yes. That was actually part of some of the reading that I did. There were bunnies involved. Indeed. But it, you know, for something that we never really hear about, I mean, I guess you can find it pretty much everywhere except Hawaii, because it's transmitted by dog ticks, which is the unusual thing, and also the Lone Star tick. But you can also get it not tick-borne, but from sick animals like rabbits or farm animals. So you can kind of get this disease a bunch of different ways. And just depending on how you get it will be how it manifests.
The only like true case of tularemia I've seen was, I'm pretty sure, from a rabbit. But now it has made me more suspicious after reading this about, do I need to consider this more with ticks too, or as a tick as the potential source? Because again, you think about classically the rabbit.
Well, right, exactly, and the most common presentation you'll see, you know, beyond the stuff that you get from the sick animals, is from the tick bite. So if you're going to see it, you're more likely to see it from a tick bite. It's just a matter of actually recognizing it.
So I guess talk about the different ways that these symptoms will present, because there's a lot of them.
And the most common presentation you'll see is called the ulcero-glandular, and that is what how it manifests when you get it from a tick bite. So it can manifest with an ulcer at the site of the bite, but again, not always that not always thing, but you generally get some pretty impressive localized adenopathy and some fever, chills, and malaise, but that's how you'll see it when you get it from a tick.
And then, of course, there's a whole bunch of other ways where you can see it too, again, depending on the source. And we'll include those in the show notes. But, you know, it's just kind of a nice little review for tularemia, because it's not something we see often. Labs, once again, aren't super helpful. So maybe a little elevation in the WBCs and the SED rate, because the SED rate goes up for anything, I'm pretty sure. Thrombocytopenia, the hyponatremia. But I feel like there's just going to be a little bit of a difference there, which is why I said with Rocky Mountains, it's sometimes going to be different than the others you see. But the elevated LFTs and the but potentially an elevation in the CPK as well. But the treatment is going to be a little more complex, because you can use doxy or cipro, but in more severe cases, it's actually recommended to treat with streptomycin or gentamicin.
And that's when you have the severe manifestations. And I just wanted to point out one of the subsets that are going to be in the show notes, the pneumonic subset, when it affects the lungs. Typically, we think of that happening from breathing in dust or breathing in the bacteria through the air, but it can progress to the pneumonic presentation from untreated the ulcero-glandular, the tick bite presentation can progress to have lung involvement as well. So that, and those are the cases that get very sick with that. So just something to keep in mind. Those would be the very sick folks that would get the streptomycin or the gentamicin in those instances.
So we're wrapping up and getting towards the last one, and it's not really an infection, it's more of a reaction. Can you explain?
Well, right, and I felt that this was very important to bring up. It's not one that the CDC tracks or this type of thing, but when I heard about it, I was just absolutely horrified. It sounds like one of the most horrible things that you could get from a tick bite, is a sudden severe allergy to red meat. I mean, that's terrible.
For me especially, like I rely a lot on red meat.
Right. All right. I think we should do like a telethon or something, like raise awareness around this or something. Anyway, I mean, it started out in the Southeast, but it's been spreading its way up. I actually read about it in the local paper this summer, and I only cried a little bit. But basically, it's the Lone Star tick is bringing it up. And what happens is the tick bites you and transmits this alpha-gal molecule. And then your body kind of hyper-reacts to it and creates this systemic immune response that will manifest the next time you have red meat. You'll have a severe allergic reaction to it. It can progress to anaphylaxis. So the treatment is like with any severe allergy, but I just thought it was worth noting just because it's a tick-borne illness that I wouldn't wish on anybody, quite frankly.
Well, and I think it's something that I guess really, unless you're a vegetarian or vegan, you'll be in the clear on this. Maybe you'll never know that you even had it. But
right, exactly.
But yeah, as far as the alpha-gal reaction and what happens there, I mean, something I take away from this is if you have someone who has anaphylaxis and they've never had an allergic reaction before and it's very sudden, like you may ask about red meat specifically. Could there be potentially this relation? And it's like you said, it's really hard to really test for, really know, but it's something that we want to at least have on our radar, if nothing else.
Right. Yeah. Plus, it's kind of cool to talk about.
Yeah. As long as you don't have it.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
So let's go ahead and let's kind of review, because we've spent quite a bit of time talking about this.
But I think it's important to go through in that kind of detail because these illnesses can be so hard to diagnose. But if you don't diagnose them correctly, you can have some pretty serious consequences for the patients.
And if you don't treat it correctly, you can also have some serious complications down the line.
Right. And because they manifest in such different ways, it makes it very difficult to diagnose. And people can be either maybe a little sick or people can be like super sick with these. So that again, it adds another level of complexity to this.
History and physical may help. A lot of times it's really hard to tell. But when in doubt, treat and usually treat with doxycycline. Get the serology testing, I at least think, to go ahead and do it. More for confirmation later. And in case you're wrong, maybe this is a different type where they're going to need a different type of antibiotic, such as babesiosis. And so start from there, build off, and make sure that you've got good follow-up with these patients because they can turn really bad really quickly.
Exactly. And you never want to delay those antibiotics because of that reason.
Chronic Lyme disease is not a thing.
Yeah, the end. But just being aware that these people are coming in on multiple hefty antibiotics. They may be coming in with PICC lines. They may be coming in with other complications. So just to have that on your radar and maybe do some education if you can, that would be nice.
All right. So we have done quite a bit of a review here, and it's always a pleasure to have you on, Michelle. But can you go ahead and give us the tagline?
Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.